Museums are important for preserving our history so that it isn't lost to future generations. But are physical museum spaces themselves a relic of the past? This is one of the best museums in the world, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. Mikhail Petrovsky is the director here, and I bet he has some answers.
History is always biased. The energy that resides in the physical space, the energy that resides in paintings, that energy cannot be fully conveyed through technology.
Restoration ends where assumption begins.
Do you think I can try my hand today?
Under very, very strict supervision.
At the Hermitage, there are two types of question that are forbidden. Why I wear my scarf all the time, and what's my favorite painting?
Professor Petrovsky, nice to meet you. Thank you very much for hosting us here. This is the Hermitage. You've been the director here for 30 years. The world has changed a lot in this time. What is the Hermitage, or how has the Hermitage changed along with it?
Right now, we're in the Winter Palace. It's part of the Hermitage and a monument to Russian statehood, but also a world-famous art museum. I do hope the Hermitage hasn't changed much in 30 years. Our job is to preserve this wonderful 19th century museum and make sure it continues to tell stories. It takes a lot of work to keep it from changing. That's why we've launched the Greater Hermitage Project. It's an entire complex of facilities, including the new buildings on Palace Square. As a result, we've doubled our exhibition space. We've also opened a storage facility at Hermitage Staraya Derevnya, that's Old Village. Finally, we've established a number of satellite museums. Previously, we had Hermitage satellites in Russia and all around the world. For now, only the Russian branches are active. While the Hermitage is a modern high-tech museum with a global presence, I believe it still manages to preserve the spirit of the 19th century.
So, history, it changes. People can manipulate history, if you will, based on their own agendas. How do you keep history from being changed so that you can, so that it is non-biased and so that it is as impartial?
History is always biased. What a museum does is give people an opportunity to make their own interpretations based on authentic pieces of history, and all the items here are authentic. We don't offer interpretations. Every person learns different things from different sources. What makes our museum great is that while we have our own viewpoint, we let everyone tell their story the way they want to tell it. Let me give you an example. We're about to enter the gallery dedicated to the Patriotic War of 1812. There are paintings there which depict the Battle of Borodino. For Russians, this was a great victory of the Russian Empire, but to the French, it was a great French victory. History is always biased that way. We've also got paintings of the Battle of Berezina. They tell the story of Napoleon fleeing Russia. And it would appear to show another great victory for Russia, wouldn't it? But we also know that the commander of the Russian army at Berezina was not included in this series of portraits because he let Napoleon's old guard get away. This shows that history can be interpreted in different ways, which can sometimes contradict each other.
So I know that a lot of museums have technology, advanced technology, like 3D exhibits, VR. They use augmented reality, maybe. How is the Hermitage adapting to this? Do you have exhibits that use new technology?
We're now in the process of creating what we call the Celestial Hermitage, and much of what we do involves cloud technology. This is especially relevant today, as Russia finds itself in an intellectual and cultural blockade. So everything we do ends up in the cloud. Now you don't have to physically come to the Hermitage to discover its treasures. All of our exhibitions are uploaded to this virtual Hermitage, and we do exclusive digital exhibitions as well. We have a series of items that we exhibit in virtual reality and put on display physically in other museums as part of Hermitage Days. Augmented reality and virtual reality have been a huge success. You can put on a special headset and float all the way to the ceiling. Take a better look at the statue of Zeus and so on. But importantly, all these cutting-edge technologies in the Hermitage must be subordinate to the 19th century aesthetic, culture and history. Technology comes and goes in waves. There are technological shifts every 5 years or so. We can no longer use discs made 5 years ago, let alone those from a decade ago. Some basic things must be preserved, regardless of the change in technology. All the more so because modern digital technology takes away from the art. It's not something that everyone understands, but a digital picture is often worse than its analog counterpart. The same way a vinyl record is better than a digital record.
Stepping into a room like this, this hallway is just magnificent. You kind of feel the history here. Is it safe to say that there will always be a place in the world for physical museum spaces?
Absolutely. Physical museums will always be around. You can talk all you want about cutting-edge technology, but the energy that resides in the physical space, the energy that resides in paintings, that energy cannot be fully conveyed through technology. Yes, technology is useful, but that's it. Here we have some portraits of men who fought in the war against Napoleon. This is the Duke of Wellington, but he served as a Russian field marshal. So he's up there. These are wonderful portraits. Over there, we've got equipment that provides detailed information about every work of art. This is one of the ways technology can help us, but it still comes down to people. There are many poems written about the people you see here, and they certainly exude the kind of energy that helps you immerse yourself in the history. Likewise, these photographs here help you understand what it was like in the years of the Great Patriotic War, during the Siege of Leningrad, when there were no portraits on display here, only empty frames. Even without the portraits, this place still had a way to speak to people.
So let's say a new piece becomes available and information comes, a new Degas or a new Renoir is discovered. What is the process? How does a museum go about acquiring that piece? And can you talk me through how do you find out about it and how do you get it here to the Hermitage?
Firstly, we don't buy things like a new Degas because we already have many of his works. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we don't always have the funds to make such grand purchases. But when we do come across something that catches our interest, there is a special committee that looks at the item, provides us a detailed description, and delivers an opinion on whether or not we should buy it. Then, with the committee, we have a discussion to answer two key questions. Do we really need it? And can we afford it? If we can, we start raising the money. I can think of one famous painting, Salvator Mundi by Leonardo da Vinci, and these people went around trying to sell it to everyone. They brought it to us as well. Not the original, of course. But once we looked at the painting, we knew right away it wasn't what we needed. We had better paintings by da Vinci. And we also have better paintings from the same school of painting. In fact, we even have a better Salvator Mundi painting by Titian. Occasionally, there is a piece we really need to buy, in which case we get all worked up, reach out to the sponsors and the patrons, and get them to buy the piece for us. Typically, the item is not some overhyped painting, but a specific work of art that the Hermitage would benefit from.
You mentioned what does the Hermitage need, or what does the Hermitage that you really, really want? Tell me, as the director here, what would you really, really like to add to the Hermitage collection?
Honestly, I can't name any. The things I do want, you simply can't buy. We could use a Vermeer, I guess. It's really difficult to get a decent Vermeer. Once there was this Vermeer painting on the market, and they said, surely some Russian tycoon will buy it and donate it to the Hermitage. There was no tycoon. But the painting wasn't that good either. You just can't get your hands on quality art. When it comes to 20th century contemporary art, we have all the essentials. We've got Dance and Music by Matisse. We've got Malevich's Black Square, a gift, by the way. And we've got The Red Wagon by Kabakov, also a donation. We have some wonderful paintings by Anselm Kiefer. So I'd say we have the 20th century covered. As for the 21st century, there aren't any artists yet that we could use.
kind of a related question, but a little more personal. What is your favorite piece, or maybe something that is closest to your heart here in the Hermitage?
Now, that's a taboo question. At the Hermitage, there are two types of question that are forbidden. Why I wear my scarf all the time, and what's my favorite painting? If I reveal my favorite painting, people will keep giving me reproductions of it all the time. The director of the Hermitage has a right to a private life. I have a book called Director's Choice. It lists all the pieces I've personally chosen, and those aren't my personal favorites, just the ones I suggest everyone should see to better understand what the Hermitage has to offer.
Now, we know that the Hermitage has large vaults, a huge collection, and museums like the Louvre and the Smithsonian in the United States, they have about 7%, only 7% of their collection on display for the public. How much do you have available to the public, percentage-wise?
That's not the right way to look at it. First, a museum is not a gallery. It exists to show only a small part of their collection. Every museum consists of collections. If you don't have collections, you're not considered a museum. People in charge of these collections study, restore, and preserve exhibits. Some of these exhibits are shown to the public in museums. That's where your figure comes from. It's usually 10% in larger museums. In smaller museums, the figure tends to be higher. And then, this doesn't apply to the Hermitage at all. Over many years, we have built a large complex of open storage facilities called Hermitage Staraya Derevnya. That's Old Village. All of our exhibits are on display there. Not like in here, where we've got a couple of paintings on each wall. Over there, we've got hundreds and hundreds of them. People go and explore the storage facilities, just like they go to restoration studios to see what our specialists do with these works of art.
We went to the Staraya Derevnya Restoration and Storage Center for ourselves to see where age-worn masterpieces get a new life. Valery, what you're doing is incredibly interesting. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I've been looking around. I see in your toolkits you have cotton swabs, you have scalpels. It seems more like a surgeon's toolkit. Are you an artist, or are you more like a doctor, a surgeon?
You are right. There are lots of similarities between medicine and restoration. We have similar instruments and do intricate work that requires focus. We care for paintings, like doctors. Medical professionals treat people. We treat canvases. The ideal situation is when there's a balance between artistic and surgical work. You must have both. Sometimes you have to perform complex, technical things that don't require artistic skills. But then you get to colors and cleaning. In order to do that, you have to know and understand a lot about art. Like in medicine, good doctors study for decades. Restoration requires that too, and we have various schools that teach the trade, from the basics to the top level. It could take decades to become a qualified specialist in this field.
So time can do very bad things to paintings, to all of us, actually. Is it possible to restore any type of painting based on any type of damage?
Yes, there are various degrees of damage. Sometimes it's very minor and doesn't require that much work. Other times, we get a severely damaged painting when, to continue with the medicine analogy, extensive surgery or treatment is required. At the Hermitage, we have exhibits that have had a troubled history. They've survived wars and all sorts. The painting I'm restoring right now is by Jan Prevoost, a Belgian artist who lived and worked at the turn of the 15th and 16th centuries. There is an amazing story behind this painting. It was trapped inside a wall for a long time. In the 1650s, there were aniconic campaigns, and many artworks were destroyed. This painting was hidden behind a church wall in Bruges. It remained there for 230 years and was discovered by accident when the French destroyed the cathedral.
What is the, if I may ask, the most damaged painting that you have personally ever had to restore?
This painting is an example of how some artwork has been badly treated. It is also by Jan Prevost, and initially it was the same size as this one. The painting was intended for an altar, so it was over 2 meters. Now only a fragment remains, which was cut out of the large canvas. It was painted over to fit into the new format. This golden background was just covered in black paint. I don't understand the artistic value of that decision. I guess they were guided by some popular trends of the time. But this is an example of the terrible damage that could be done to a painting when it's cut into pieces, washed out, painted over, changed drastically, in accordance with the trends, or anything like that. Our goal is to restore the original appearance intended by the author. Art history is based on original works, the colors and palette. In order to avoid false attribution or other misconceptions, we need to uncover the truth. And that is what we try to do. If possible, we remove all other layers and uncover the original painting, presenting it to the viewer in the way it was first created.
Now, Valeria, I've been watching you work. I think I'm ready. Are you ready to give me a try? I want to help.
I think you will have this opportunity after you study the trade for 10 years or so. We know of situations when people without any special training try to do this work and end up ruining everything. So I wouldn't recommend it.
So not today. Andre, thank you very much for meeting with us today. The work you do is very important. In my opinion, you're incredibly brave to take your hands and put them to history like this. Talk to me about the process. When a painting comes in until when it goes out, how do you do your work?
First, we evaluate the condition of the painting, the extent of the damage, and develop our restoration plan. After we make sure that the painting has been sufficiently consolidated and it won't crumble, we figure out if we need to use varnish or reconstruct lost fragments. This step differs from case to case. Not all paintings require clearance works or further restoration, so consolidation is the most important step.
Mm-hmm. One thing that impresses me is the use of color. Sometimes colors can't be found like they were originally. What do? You just take a new paint, a new color, and put it in there? Because a trained eye, you would notice, but I wouldn't notice the difference between the blue that I find in the store today and the blue that was used originally.
Some colors are impossible to replicate, even though we have equivalents for some, like synthetic ultramarine for madder lake and other natural red pigments that were made from bugs and snails. Nobody's replicating those processes today. We replace them with advanced synthetic materials. At the same time, the key is to have a good grasp of the artist's technique and methods, the pigments that were used, and that helps you find the correct approach to the restoration by imitating the artist as closely as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, we spoke a little bit about this off camera, but you have to go down to the original layer to make sure that you restore a painting down to its original glory, if you will. There have been famous examples of people who think that they're doing the right thing and think that they're doing a good job and have just done tremendous damage to the work. How do you prevent that? And does it break your heart when you see those sorts of things online?
Of course, sometimes amateur can serve as spoil paintings, and it often comes to light as the damage is usually obvious. Actually, the rule is very simple here. Focus on the loss and don't try to become a co-author. A fine art conserver is a conserver first and foremost. We must suppress our creative urge. We only restore what's lost and respect the art on our work table. Interference should be reduced to a minimum. Our golden rule, only do what's necessary. The best path to our goal is the path of least impact. Well, there's also a great quote from Cesare Brandi. Restoration ends where assumption begins. Not everybody works by these words. Some are so self-confident they say they know what they're doing and they're doing it right. But in fact, if a person is 100% confident, this profession is not for them. You should always have a grain of doubt.
That having been said, I'm a little bit of an artist myself. I have the uniform. We're dressed the same way. Do you think I can try my hand today and we can start? I can work here together with you?
Under very, very strict supervision.
All right, thank you again for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, we've spoken with the restoration artists. They have a very important job, an incredibly tense job. What happens if you get a piece that is too damaged to be restored? Do you keep it in the vaults, or do you keep it for historical reasons, or?
The decision is made by an expert commission on a case-by-case basis. Each item has... There's an old conservation rule in the Venice Charter that says we shouldn't rebuild what's gone. And in Palmyra, in Syria, where we're involved in the restoration process, we often hear, stop it, it's destroyed, so let it be. When that crazy vandal spilled acid over Rembrandt's Danae, some parts of it were lost forever. Some suggested we shouldn't do anything, let it be a monument to vandalism. But in fact, it's important to restore it, to the extent of what's possible. It's not about painting anew. We've conserved what we could. Some parts are damaged beyond repair, but still, Danae is a masterpiece, even though its appearance has changed. Every time we have to make this decision, one thing is certain. We mustn't add anything, and our intrusion must be reversible. For example, when we add varnish over a big hole, we add toner so the hole doesn't interfere with our perception of what's left. This kind of interference must be reversible. That layer should be removable. Here in the Hermitage, our approach to restoration is very conservative. We never aim to restore a painting to a fresh condition. That would be wrong. The artist knew the painting would date and what it would look like in 20 years. That's our take on the issue. It's really quite a conservative one. But we try to restore paintings to let our visitors enjoy them. If the piece is destroyed completely, however, we have to wait. We had some of Peter the Great's outfits. We have a lot of them in our collection, and their exhibition is coming soon. Some of them were considered damaged beyond repair, but new technology rolled in, and now they're restored. Even though we didn't add anything to them, just revived and reshaped the damaged parts.
You have said that art and exhibitions are an important cultural dialogue. Now that dialogue between countries and has become complicated, let's say, do you think that art can serve as a moderator to help get people talking again, get countries talking again?
In my opinion, international dialogue will resume through museums and exhibitions. We've been here before, during the Cold War. The dialogue between museums precedes the re-establishment of diplomatic relationships. The opposite is also true. Museum exchange between Russia and the United States discontinued 15 years ago. It was the first signal. Nobody knew back then that it was to herald a new page in our relations. Still, dialogue continues. We have telecommunications that let us share treasures across our borders. Many other exhibition venues also exist, so the interactions won't stop completely. And we always try to negotiate any obstacles we encounter. There were a lot of them in the past. The Hermitage's history spans three revolutions, three wars, evacuations, exchanges, and everything in between. We've been there. We know what to do. We know our way around decolonization as well. We have vast experience. And by keeping up our work, we explore opportunities to build new bridges with our colleagues on the foundations of burnt ones.
Now, museums are kind of like a living organism. They breathe, they need oxygen. You need freedom, you need movement so that people in different countries can see your exhibitions and breathe life into the Hermitage. What destinations would you like to take the love of this place to next?
As I said before, it's cloud technology. Even on YouTube, virtual tours have so many views. We couldn't even dream of that number of in-person visits, as we've learned during the pandemic, and that's great. Plus, we still have partners that remain accessible to us, like in the Gulf states. Our twin museum, the Louvre of Abu Dhabi, for example. You can't go to the Louvre these days, but in Abu Dhabi, the doors are open. We have collaboration projects in China, Malaysia, and Southeast Asia for people who miss out on the opportunity to visit Russia. But we love it much more when people come here or visit our online exhibitions. We're reluctant to transport our pieces elsewhere. It's perilous. Too dangerous to take our collections to other countries. Exhibiting them here or on the internet is much safer.
Professor, thank you very much. It has been an incredibly interesting conversation in a fascinating place, of course.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.